KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Once he realized that we weren't screwing around, and we had watched 846 episodes of Cops and analyzed them all and did a huge data analysis, I think it was just sort of like, well, I got it.
Dan Taberski set out to investigate the darker aspects of the long-running show, Cops. When he asked for an interview with series creator John Langley, he was shut out at first. Then Langley learned the podcast was happening with or without him. Taberski tells us about making Running from Cops the product of an 18-month deep dive into the show. Turns out if you live in a town where it films, cops might come for you, whether you're a bad boy or not. Taberski also reflects on his time as a Daily Show field producer during the Jon Stewart years and talks about blowback from his earlier podcast about exercise guru Richard Simmons. But first on the news banter, Iron Man is more like Platinum Man. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my superhero sidekick and banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, superheroes. Disney, as we, I think, predicted because, duh, is raking in money hand over fist on Avengers Endgame, just shattering record after record. With this completion of the Avengers arc, Robert Downey Jr., I don't know how to quite phrase it. He has made out very, very well for playing Iron Man. To say that somebody deserves the kind of payday that he has gotten probably sounds crazy to a lot of people in the real world. But certainly, if you're going to give credit, Kevin Feige and the team at Marvel deserve credit. But putting Robert Downey Jr. in as Iron Man at a time when he was really considered borderline unemployable, drug problems, problems, you know, just didn't seem like he was going to be a commercial movie star. And then even making Iron Man, this was a bold and audacious move. It paid off for Marvel and certainly paid off hugely for Robert Downey Jr.
If you think about Robert Downey Jr., he is the equivalent of a neighbor of Steve Jobs who happened to invest in Apple in the early 80s and has just ridden it. He was in on the ground floor of these Marvel movies. And now, 22 films later, I think 8 or 9 of which he has starred in, he has made hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, our reporting is just on the previous Avengers film, Avengers Infinity War. He made more than $75 million, and that's just on one film because he was in early and they did not have options on him after Iron Man, so he was able to negotiate back-end points on all the movies he appears in. That is significant when you're talking about movies that are making $2 billion at the box office, and Avengers Endgame could make even more.
Yeah, I mean, this is so striking when you look back. The whole saga is striking. Marvel was, you know, it was licensing its characters to other studios. And this has also turned into a way that Robert Downey Jr. gets paid. For example, before Marvel decided to go out and make its own movies, they licensed, obviously, X-Men to Fox, and they licensed Spider-Man to Sony, to Columbia Pictures. And just for being in the 2017 movie Spider-Man Homecoming and working for 3 days, Robert Downey Jr. made $5 million a day. And I would think that Sony, which collaborated with Disney on that film, because Kevin Feige really has the secret sauce when it comes to these movies and they needed to relaunch Spider-Man, you know, Sony would think it was worth it.
Yeah, I mean, that's nice work if you can get it. But it is a culmination of the goodwill that has been built up over all of these Marvel movies. The ability of Marvel to hold the line on the rest of the Avengers and all of these various stars that now do superhero movies is pretty significant. Downey is the only one that gets back end. And the others are paid well, but they're able to do these movies like Avengers with dozens of top actors in them because they're not paying back end and they're not paying outrageously exorbitant salaries for some of these actors. And people in Hollywood now who once might have turned their noses at being in a superhero movie are lining up to be in one.
Yes, the world has changed, and obviously these movies are the envy of every other studio. I mean, they've just allowed Disney to take over the world. And when I say take over the world, I'm going to include China. you know, it's funny because Disney also has Star Wars, and that has not managed to gain any traction in China. But already in China, having just opened, Avengers Endgame has made more than $500 million just in that market.
Yeah, and the numbers on Avengers Endgame are staggering. I mean, you mentioned earlier that we predicted this. I don't want to toot my own horn here. I did not predict the numbers. I mean, we did an office pool at Hollywood Reporter. I was $100 million low on what the domestic opening would be. And the person who won our pool was $50 million below the $350 million that it opened to in the U.S. And that's just the U.S. Overseas, they added another $850. I mean, it was $1.2 billion for one weekend. There had never been a movie that had opened to a billion-dollar week. So these numbers are just staggering. And now the question is, can it beat Avatar? The number is $2.8 billion, and Avatar got there in 2009, 2010. We'll see if Avengers can get there. It has a lot more competition than Avatar did back then, but this weekend will be key.
Yeah, and it also has China, which is obviously going to be huge. So let's bear in mind, it's not a totally fair comparison. Let me switch over to another Endgame, seemingly. The agents and the writers still seem to be stalled out. And as you know, Matt, we've been hearing from some of the most powerful agents in this town. And their message, as I think we talked before about the fact that the writers now have sued the agents and gone to court, what they're trying to do, the agents, it seems, is to split the leadership of the guild from the rank and file and say that the leadership is unrealistic and hoping that there will be restlessness on the part of writers. But right now, last I heard from one of the, as I said, most powerful people in this community, you know, they made an offer, which I think the consensus is was not a very good offer to share packaging fees with the writers, and they're not planning to return to the table. I think they're taking a tremendous risk with this court case pending because I think they could potentially lose.
Yeah, and that would be catastrophic. I mean, more and more you hear rumblings around town as to whether this is just the beginning, whether the Writers Guild really has their sights set on redefining how money is transferred all over Hollywood. Will they go after the managers next? Will they go after lawyers and the 5% commission that they charge? This is really a mission of the Writers Guild and its lead negotiator, David Young. And we don't know where this ends, but there is a gigantic risk. This is now in a court's hand. So potentially a judge or jury could determine the entire fee structure for the business and how talent pays their representatives.
Yeah, I mean, you have to think in most of these cases that there's a settlement at the courthouse door. It's just very hard to see right now with the bitterness that is setting in. But, you know, we have seen these fights before where it looked grim. It's just that I don't know what would be acceptable quite at this point to the guild if you assume that their position, you know, that they want to do away with packaging fees and get the agencies out of the producing business. You know, where is the compromise? How much are they willing to compromise? That's what's not clear to me.
At least for now, it doesn't seem like there's much compromise going on anywhere. So this is likely going to not be resolved until there's some kind of initial court ruling.
I will go into the office pool and predict it won't get to a final court verdict. But, you know, if the court shows some disposition to entertain the writers' grievances, yeah, I believe that would spur the agents back to the table. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter.
Due to the graphic nature of this program, viewer discretion is advised.
Dan Taberski was a longtime fan of the Fox show Cops, a series of such lasting appeal that it's now in its 31st season with more than 1,000 episodes in the can. Taberski was long curious about what went into the making of this enduring money machine. For his new podcast, Running from Cops, he and his team watched more than 800 episodes and started seeking people featured on the show, both officers and suspects. Often they found an appearance on Cops could change your life, much, much for the worse if you were on the wrong side of the law. Then there were other troubling issues, like who controls what's seen on the screen. Before Taberski became a full-time podcaster, he worked in reality TV and was in the room for some extremely awkward interviews on The Daily Show, where he was a field producer for several years starting in 1999. I think we've had a couple of Daily Show talents on our show, and yeah. We've talked about it from their end, but I wonder what the field producing was like.
It was awkward and exciting. When I was there, we were booking interviews in D.C., like with senators and stuff, and we would say we were from The Daily Show, and they didn't know what that was, really, because there was a moment where they didn't even have Comedy Central in Washington. So I had done interviews with people, and you say that they're from The Daily Show, and they think Today Show, so it felt very, like, it felt subversive. I learned a lot, but it was very awkward often.
Did politicians start saying, yeah, I know who you are, I'm not doing it?
Yeah, I mean, gosh, if memory serves, the 2000 election was like the first time where it was covered by The Daily Show in a pretty aggressive way. They knew who we were, but they also at the same time got the sense that if they play along, that they could be in on the joke instead of made the joke. Mm-hmm. You know, John McCain did one of the first. They followed him on the bus when John McCain was traveling for the campaign and he got it. He sort of got in on the joke.
Yeah, he would get it. Yeah.
Yeah. It was like a watershed moment.
So it was, in fact, fun. I just want to be clear. It was fun.
So much fun.
I mean, sometimes as a viewer, you say to yourself, why is this person sitting there? Don't they know that they look like an idiot? Do they know in real time? Do they go jump up afterwards and say, you can't air that because I look like an idiot?
There are some people, like people who want to make sure that toy guns that look like real guns can stay legal. Like those people, you don't feel bad. You're going after a target that deserves it, right? Mm-hmm. So the awkwardness is not a problem. And that was John's big thing, is like, know how to pick your targets. If you're going to go after somebody who really deserves it. Somebody who says that smoking doesn't cause cancer. I did a big piece with Stephen Colbert about that. And so you feel less bad because what they're saying is aberrant. And so the point you're making is worth it. But otherwise, I think you'd be surprised at how good of a sense of humor people have about themselves. And even in the most awkward interviews, when they see the final product, I think there's a certain joy about being a part of a larger joke. And sometimes it goes too far, but when it doesn't, when it hits that sweet spot, my experience is that most people really end up finding it funny.
Huh.
Well, yeah.
Good. So you didn't have to run for your life too often.
I got kicked out of a couple of places.
Did you?
Yeah, just a couple.
So you segue at this point. You have been podcast guy for several years. I don't know how many years, but several.
I think it's 3 years now.
I mean, you know, I know that I've seen with my own eyes, as everybody has, or heard with our own ears, the proliferation of amazing podcasts.
It's crazy.
What made you decide to do that? And how did you do it? I think a lot of people want podcasts, but not everybody gets to have one. Or maybe everybody does. I don't know. I could be wrong.
I don't know. I mean, it's different because even the word podcasting is such a broad term now, right? Like there's so many different types of podcasts and so many of the podcasts out there are talk podcasts. They're very inexpensive to make and you can do a lot of them. And so there's a different sort of monetizing system that goes with that. I think what I ended up doing is more in the documentary podcast space where you end up spending like 18 months like putting this thing together. And I'm only making 6 episodes per season. So that's harder to monetize. And so I don't know how I got lucky enough to be able to do these. But basically, it started with Missing Richard Simmons. And I was making it a documentary. And then I spoke to some folks at First Look Media. And I told them about what I was working on. I had already started shooting it myself on my phone because I had saw the movie Tangerine. And I said, if Sean Baker can do it, I can do it. And so I started shooting interviews with people saying, what happened to Richard? And then they heard the idea and they just immediately thought maybe it's a podcast. And it made total sense to me that it made more sense as a podcast than a film.
The genesis of that was that you had known Richard Simmons?
Yeah, I had been trying to make a documentary with Richard Simmons for a couple of years. I had started taking his class at Slimmons in Beverly Hills in, I believe, 2012, 2011. And the very first day I took the class, I said, would you ever, and the class is crazy. It's crazy. Like people, shirts off and he's crying and he's laughing. And it's this really sort of joyous, emotional atmosphere. And I asked him the first day if he would ever let me direct a documentary about him. And he said no, but he kind of winked. And so I said, all right, I'll just keep taking the class. And so I took the class for a year. And during that time, we started having lunches and dinners and meetings and talking more and more about this project. And then he, for lack of a better word, disappeared. He stopped being Richard Simmons. And he cut off all friends and family. And I just sort of let it go. And I figured, well, that's that. And then I realized he wasn't talking to anybody. And then people were approaching me saying, here's what's going on. And do you know what's happening? And what his representatives were saying weren't matching up with the real story. And it was just quite concerning. And so I started pursuing it in the sense that all these people were talking about this thing that they were concerned. And so it was just something I wanted to pursue.
It was a successful podcast, I think. But then you took a certain amount of blowback. And I wonder if you felt like, okay, I learned a lesson from this, or I just don't agree with that blowback. The blowback being that you were invading his privacy and stalking him, and if he wanted to be left alone, leave him alone.
I mean, the blowback was certainly interesting. Yeah, I learned a lot. I for sure learned that once you make something, it's out of your hands. The minute it becomes a thing, then everybody starts talking about it, and they can sort of take it in the direction that they want to. Like, for example, you know, I went to Richard's house. I knocked on his door twice.
Yes, and I think it was the New York Times that kind of jumped on you for that, right?
Yeah, totally, which is hilarious. I think part of the problem was that I let people hear the process of me knocking on the door, and that's what you do. If you're trying to figure out what's going on with somebody, you call them, you email them, you knock on their door, like you do basic reporter things, right? And I think reporters just never show that process. And so I think that was a little, I was sort of pulling back the curtain a little bit that made it seem more invasive than it was. In fact, like 95% of what I talked about in that podcast was already out there. And there were a lot of things we didn't talk about because we didn't want to invade his privacy. And so we were super aware of it at the time that we didn't want to cross a line. But we also knew that we were walking up to the line. And we felt that asking these questions, asking really hard questions like, what do we owe each other? Like, is it okay to just end a friendship like that? What is the responsibility of fame? You know, as somebody who saves thousands of lives by sharing their intimate personal story with somebody and makes millions of dollars doing it, is there a sense of responsibility that you can't just cut it off on a day? So all those things we thought were worth asking. But I also understand that when you ask tough questions, people are allowed to ask me tough questions in return.
So did it inform your thinking? The next thing you did was a Y2K doc, audio doc. And then you followed it with this Cops podcast, which we're going to talk about more. But did you say, you know, I'm never going to do X again? Or did you say,
no,
I just have to be prepared to take the shots?
Yeah, I think I have to be prepared to take the shots. But it was such an unusual project. You know, it was just the kind of thing, like, I wasn't an outsider coming into this world of Richard Simmons, you know. Like, I knew these people. I knew Richard Simmons. I knew his manager. I knew all this world. I was kind of in the middle of it. And so it's not like you ever say, well, I'm never doing that one again, because it would never happen again. Being in that situation would never happen again. But I am very conscious of respecting somebody's privacy, and even more so now, for sure.
So, Cops.
Yeah.
You were into Cops. You were a Cops guy.
Yeah, a lot.
You loved watching Cops, I read.
Sure did. Yeah, for years and years. I grew up watching television as background noise. You know, I like having something on, and that had always been the perfect thing. And so I would sort of watch it with two minds, right? I would watch it with, this is captivating. On the flip side, I would also look at it and think to myself, how are they doing this? Like,
right.
Why are they allowed to do this? How do the police participate? How does this work?
You talk earlier in the podcast about, I mean, this thing was like a money machine, not that expensive to produce.
Yeah.
And blocks and blocks. I forget the numbers you used. Like, they're airing, I don't know how many episodes a week.
It's been on for 30 seasons. There's been well over 1,000 episodes. You know, there are days where it airs 15, sometimes 20 times in a day. There have been weeks often where it airs at least 70 times in a week. And it's sort of that place where it's not a television show anymore. It's something else. I wish there was a word for it. But it's on so much that it's just this constant message that's out there. And even if you're not watching it, a lot of people are. You know, we start the podcast with these two kids, with this YouTube video I found of two kids. And they're not playing cops and robbers. They're playing cops.
Get down on the ground now! So, why were you running tonight? Huh? Why are we running? On your knees. Hey! Stop resisting!
And they're maybe 11 years old. They were born around season 19 of Cops.
Yes.
And now they're at the point where they can reenact the cadence, the language, the behavior of these police. And they're only 11 years old for a show that's been on for 30 years. So it just speaks to the power of having that sort of message out there that often.
Coming up after a short break, Dan Taberski tells us about a last-minute find, raw footage from a drug bust that seemed to tell a very different story from what was eventually seen on Cops. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Dan Taberski about his new podcast, Running from Cops, which takes a close look at the long-running show, Cops. Taberski and three producers spent a year and a half analyzing more than 800 shows and interviewing more than 100 people, including Cops creator John Langley. Taberski also talked to Stephen Chow, a TV executive who was a hitmaker at Fox after his massive success with America's Most Wanted. Chow told Taberski about getting a pitch in the late 1980s from John Langley, who brought along footage of a big-time drug bust in Broward County, Florida.
And he showed me this, and my mind was blown. And I was like, wow, I'm in love. I'm speechless now. And John, in this very casual way, said to me, I can do this for you every week. And he goes, I'm the pizza man. I deliver. I looked at him. I said,
that's super lame.
So it was like he was so calm about it. He goes, I deliver.
It's funny. You interview Stephen Chow, who is the Fox executive who started this Rupert Murdoch favorite, Cops. I think he was a Rupert Murdoch favorite. Stephen Chow, as you, I don't think, mentioned, was a guy who ultimately got fired for bringing a stripper to a to a business meeting, very high-level people, which is how he's going
to
be remembered.
Lynn Cheney was on stage, and he hired a stripper to strip in front of her to prove a point about censorship, and he got canned.
Yes, and Rupert Murdoch fell out of love with him in that moment.
Yeah, so it goes.
But Stephen Chow, I mean, did he say, sure, I'll talk about Cops, but don't ask me about the stripper, or did he just say, sure, I'll talk about Cops, and you felt like the stripper was not part of that story?
I asked him about the stripper. I mean, we were going to put it in there, but at some point he was just so captivating and interesting that, like, it just fell out because everything else was he was saying about when Cops started and all that stuff was so interesting. No, he was an open book. He came to the interview wearing a Cops sweatshirt. He is down with Cops. So it's really fun to talk to somebody like that when they're not bashful about it, you know, about creating something in the culture that's controversial or that people kind of crap on a little bit. Like, he's not bashful about it. He's proud of it, and he defends it, and that makes him for an interesting person to talk to.
And then there's John Langley, the creator of Cops. I used to start to challenge him.
I've talked to people who said they don't remember signing the lease.
Yeah, I've talked to many, too, because we get sued like everybody in media. And they say, oh, I didn't know I signed that. And you know what I say to that? Bull.
He seems to start to get a little bit like, I'm not having that much fun right now.
Yeah. That is true. You know, it took me months to just get him to talk to me. Months.
He wasn't like Stephen Chow, like, sure, I'll come in my Cop sweatshirt.
Well, I'll tell you this. Stephen Chow wouldn't do it unless I talked to Langley first. And then I finally convinced Langley. I said, look, we're doing this. I'm not a huge fan of access in terms of being the thing that hinges on whether you do it or not. Like, if there's something important to talk about, it's important to talk about. And just because I don't have the people who were the primary people in the beginning, it doesn't mean there's not this whole world, you know, sort of circling around them that is full of texture and interesting things to say. But that being said, once he realized that we weren't screwing around and we had watched 846 episodes of Cops and analyzed them all and did a huge data analysis, I think it was just sort of like, well, I got it.
These guys are serious.
We were serious. We are serious, yeah.
So when you say access journalism, I mean, there are editors in print as well that will say, if you don't get the subject of this story to talk to you, we're not doing the story. But you and I both agree that that is absolutely not necessary. And you go ahead and start reporting and the subject either comes along or doesn't. Doesn't mean you're not going to get perfectly good information, write a great story or do a great podcast. So in the time when you were leading up trying to persuade John Langley to talk to you about Cops, you said it took months. So what were you doing in those months?
We set up a team of six screeners to watch and analyze and catalog 846 episodes of Cops by crime, by type of crime, by race, by gender. We wanted to see what you couldn't notice by just watching an episode or two. We wanted to see what the pattern was over 30 years. And so that was one thing we were doing. And then the second thing we were doing is we were interviewing officers who had been on Cops. We were interviewing everybody, sound guys, camera guys, anybody who had a tangential connection to it. We were interviewing criminal justice experts in terms of the portrayals of criminal justice in the media and how that sort of affects the way we look at policing and crime. And then the other big part of what we were doing is we were trying to find suspects who had been on the show.
And some of them seem very surprised that you actually find them.
It's not easy to find those people. You know, a lot of times we would pick a city. We picked a few cities, Pasco County, Florida, Spokane, Washington. Wichita, Kansas.
Did you just throw darts at a board, or you're looking north, south? You're looking at north, south, Midwest, or how do you pick?
We were looking for a diversity of location, but we were also looking for places where live PD, where the show Live PD was active as well, because that is sort of what comes up. That's sort of the next generation of cops, which is even more extreme. And so we wanted to see how they affect these communities. So we were trying to double down in communities that sort of had experience in both. And also, we just wanted to go to places where cops had been a lot, because we knew that it was going to be a crapshoot to even find these people. You know, we would try to find information by looking at the cops episode, like street signs. If there's a store in the background, we would call the store, ask them if they knew anything. We would take screen grabs of people, of suspects, and then compare them to mugshots who had been arrested in that city around that time. It was laborious, but so worthwhile. So worthwhile based on what we found.
So you found out a number of things about cops that did not necessarily reinforce your desire to watch the show. Yeah. One of them that you mentioned is these field drug tests. I mean, these tests are very, very discredited. And as you point out, they don't mention that in Cops. You play some tape of this cops saying, yep, this is cocaine.
If it ends up being cocaine, it'll have a blue or a blue over pink change to it, and that would be cocaine.
They never talk about the unreliability of the tests or whether it actually was cocaine.
Right, exactly. And so you see this arrest, and you just assume that, you know, like in Cops, they say all suspects are innocent until proven guilty in the court of law, right? Like that's what the announcer says with a big husky voice at the beginning of every episode. And then everything else in the show is edited to point toward guilt. Nobody believes that, right? Like, nobody watches that show and thinks, yeah, they're probably innocent. For the most part, everybody seems guilty. You just assume. They're explaining away behavior. They look nervous. The cops look sure of themselves. The tests look definitive. And just in that one case, it's a case in Gwinnett County, Georgia, where it's a cocaine bust, and they show this really simple Nick test. Pink is no cocaine. Blue is cocaine. Easy peasy. And then we looked into it, and turns out it wasn't cocaine. And those people were arrested under wrongful conditions. And not only was it not cocaine, that episode aired a month after the state test came back saying it wasn't cocaine. So that was in 2013. A state test came back 6 months after that arrest saying it was, in fact, not cocaine. The show Cops aired that segment anyway, showing these people getting arrested, looking like it's obviously cocaine. And then they're still airing it. The last time they aired it was March 9th.
Wow.
In repeats. Yeah. So this affects people. This affects people's lives. And I will say, we go back to that episode in episode 6 because what happens in the last episode is what happens is that a few weeks ago, literally about a month ago at this point, like way at the tail end of our reporting, we found raw video of that cop segment of that cocaine bust in Gwinnett County, Georgia. What's portrayed as a 7-minute arrest is actually an hour and 37-minute raw tape of what they actually shot. And I don't want to say what I saw on that video, but I will say, we talk about it in the podcast. I will say that it shocked the hell out of me.
It wasn't good.
It was not good. You know, and I'm sure the Langleys will dispute this, but from what I saw, they didn't just tell a shorter story or a simpler story. They told a story that was radically different from the one that tape shows.
Yes, it wasn't it was a false positive. It was much worse.
It was worse.
It was bad.
Yeah, it's bad. It's not good. And that's the, you know, it's impossible to get, you know, we still haven't heard Trump on The Apprentice and outtakes, right? Like, it's impossible to get reality show footage. And so I didn't expect to get it. It was a gift. But I will say, work with really smart people and also work long enough. Like, 18 months is a long time to be spending on one subject. We interviewed 105 people, and that was just recorded in interviews. So I didn't want to just be a flibbity-gibbet, like, make just sort of, you know, here's what I think about the show Cops. Like, I wanted to see what I was watching this whole time and how real is it. And so we put the time in, and hopefully that shows in the project.
Dan Taberski is the creator and host of the Headlong podcast, Running from Cops. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, it's so my pleasure. Thanks so much.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance this week from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe and listen to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.